Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. And sitting across from me is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
The sun shone, having no alternative on the nothing new. Welcome to part two of our story about Hewlett-Packard.
Which has been a company about almost everything new in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it was all about new measuring devices for other devices.
Yep. If you're just tuning in, two guys named Bill and Dave decided to work in a garage. Create a company because they were both electrical engineers, and their mentor from college, from Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, said, "Hey, you know, you should come up with some kind of measurement tools that will be able to help companies identify negative feedback." And they did, and then they started making other kinds of products too, and gradually, and when I say gradually, very rapidly, in a burgeoning electronic field, were able to demonstrate their leadership both as innovators in technology and innovators in price, were able to accumulate a pretty big business customer base in very short time. They also did a lot to help employees and change the way people did business in the United States.
And if you're wondering about other famous companies that began as a business run out of a garage in California, look up companies like Apple, Microsoft, and Google.
Yes.
Because as it turns out, if you want to create a technology company in California, your best bet is to start in someone's garage. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be yours either.
You know, I have a carport, and I feel like most of my projects are sort of open-ended.
Right, right.
So, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, you don't have the full protection that a garage provides.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I've got a garage, but I only run a lemonade stand, and unfortunately my garage does not face the road, so it has had some hard times starting off. Also, we're in the winter right now, so not a huge demand. Clearly, I should have looked at my goals a little more closely before I launched this endeavor. Mm-hmm. But let's get back to HP.
Yeah, we decided we were going to take a break toward the end of the 1950s, before the end of the 1950s, literally, because, again, as you're just tuning in, HP has grown so much in its first 20 years
First 20 years.
Just making sure I did my math right. it has decided that it can grow globally, and it decides to open its own marketing group in Switzerland and a manufacturing operation in Germany.
Yep. So now we've got locations in Europe and in the United States, and it has become a multinational corporation.
Yes.
Also in 1959, HP acquired its second company, the Boonton Radio Corporation, which was originally founded in 1934. And this company created electronic test equipment. So right there in HP's wheelhouse. So the company is kind of solidifying its place in the electronics market. And again, still really concentrating on one particular set of electronic devices, stuff that's not for consumers. I think it's interesting because, Chris, now when you think of HP today, you often – what sort of products do you think of?
Well, I think of consumer products, especially computers.
Right.
Because that's what I see – more advertising for and
computers. I tend to think also of printers.
Yes.
HP is very big in the world of printers. So we tend to think of these devices as HP. If you say HP today, and we'll get to it in our third part about how when HP was looking at the possibility of spinning off its personal computer business, everyone freaked out. But really, when you look at the history of the company as a whole, the personal computer business is just a very tiny sliver of what that company is all about. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to forget that because that's sort of the face that the public is really familiar with. Mm-hmm. But yes, this Boonton Radio Corporation was more along the lines of what the real core of HP's business was all about, creating these devices that help companies measure and quantify what their systems are doing. This is really important in businesses like radio or telecommunications, where you build up these complex networks, these complex infrastructures, and you have to be able to test different parts of the infrastructure to make sure everything's working properly.
Right. Well, as you pointed out too, you might think that a company that is started and organized and run by engineers might be more methodical and may not necessarily have that business aspect to it, where the person running the company is a real business person.
Mm-hmm.
But Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard always had the sort of an idea of how they wanted to run a company.
Yeah.
Behind it, and they came up with the HP way of doing things, and Mr. Packard came up with his
11 rules,
his 11
interpersonal
rules.
Interactions.
And those included keeping an eye on your core businesses and growing to make sure that you're competitive in the
right.
future.
Right.
And this acquisition sort of, I think, exemplifies that, because it is both of those things.
Yeah. And also in 1959, that was the year, if you listened to our previous podcast about HP, I mentioned that HP had created a spin-off company called, originally Dynac, but then later Dymec.
Mm-hmm.
And they figured out the name by flipping the HP logo upside down and saying, hey, this HP looks like a DY. Well, in 1959, that's when they folded Dymec back into the HP. Actually, I guess not back into, but brought Dymec under the fold of the umbrella of HP.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a division within the company. Now, in 1958, that was when HP had created this whole division structure. So Dymec became its own sort of autonomous division within HP.
And that organization was built to basically offer solutions to customers using HP products.
Yeah.
So it made sense that they weren't so far removed from the mother company that it was going to be a poor fit.
Now, do you have anything for 1960? Because my next note is for 61.
Yep, another acquisition?
They acquired the Sanborn Company, which was a medical equipment manufacturer.
Now, this is a bit of a different field for them.
Right. And this would be part of HP for, well, several decades. It would eventually spin off, and we'll talk about that when it happens. But this was an attempt on HP's part to really kind of broaden its horizons and get into
sure.
some industries that at this point it really hadn't dipped its toe into. And also in 1961, it was a big year for HP, because on March 17th, it listed for the very first time on the New York Stock Exchange.
Yes.
So, it had launched its IPO previously, but now it's actually listed on the NYSE, which mm-hmm. that's a big deal for a company.
Yes, yes. And as a matter of fact, in 62, HP had another famous organization take note of them, Fortune, the magazine. They were named to the Fortune 500 list at number 460. It's hard for me to believe now that HP was ever that low on that list.
Yeah.
But, they did start at one point.
Yep. And this is, again, it's the company's not even 30 years old yet. And
that's impressive.
Yeah, and it makes the Fortune 500 list. And it's pretty impressive. And that year, they brought in revenues of around $110 million. And they had more than 6,000 employees by now. So big jump from that two-employee operation run out of a garage in Palo Alto.
Yes, indeed.
So in 1963, the company comes up with the 5100A frequency analyzer,
mm-hmm.
which, it's one of those pieces of equipment, again, not meant for the average consumer unless you go into space.
Yeah. Now, if you want to take a look at these, HP has a lot of pictures of these, and I don't know if you took a look at some of them. For some of these products, brochures as well to sell those products,
right?
Which are very, very entertaining. But you can get an idea of looking at these early instruments that HP was providing. Now, the documentation I read about them was that they weren't glamorous. They weren't pretty boxes, but they worked very well.
The early ones were actually housed in wooden boxes, wooden cabinets, but eventually, HP decided that this sort of decorative finish, all it really did was it added bulk and expense to the item, and it wasn't really useful. I mean, there was a time early in the history of HP's products where if you bought one of these devices, it would be have, you know, the metal front facing with all the controls and everything. And then the actual frame was wood. And they used oak, by the way.
Interesting.
That was the wood of choice. Yes. They decided not to go with the industry standard, and they decided to go with oak. By the way, when you talk about those brochures trying to sell these products, I can't help but think of like the stereotypical 1950s commercial where you hear like the music, and you say, have you come back from a long day at work only to jump into your deep space exploration vehicle and realize you don't have a frequency analyzer? We have just the item for you.
And it sounds like the Raymond Scott accompanied item of the future,
yes,
sort of thing.
Yeah.
These pieces of equipment, since they weren't really aimed at the consumer market, they're the kinds of things that look like they came off the set of a 1950s science fiction film when they're trying to recreate the control room of a spaceship.
Yeah, these are definitely
stuff that beeps.
Yeah, exactly. These are definitely the machines that go ping.
Yes.
And also
but they did their actual work very well.
Yes.
Not exciting to look
at. Yeah, no, it's if to the average person, it looks like, you know, random piece of electronic equipment A.
Hey, it's got a meter on it. What does it do? It measures the sound frequencies. Yeah. There. Really? What does it do?
Why does it do that?
It's important. It's useful. But,
That's the trick of really learning about HP's early products is that if you really want to know why these things were important, we'd have to do like two more podcasts just to explain the equipment that this stuff was used to measure.
Yes, but it helped the companies that used them measurably.
Yes. Well, in 1963, they also entered their first joint venture.
Yes.
They formed the Yokogawa Hewlett-Packard Venture.
In Tokyo.
Yeah. So this, again, shows that the company is looking to expand, and this the Yokogawa Hewlett-Packard Venture would actually meet with great success.
Absolutely.
Become very a very powerful company in its own right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So 1964.
We have some titles coming down.
Yep. Packard becomes the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, and Hewlett becomes the president of Hewlett-Packard.
Mm-hmm. He was also Packard was also the chairman.
Yes, he would later become the chairman as well. And in fact,
old Blue Eyes. No, wait, that's a different chairman.
Different chairman of the board. In fact, eventually, not yet, but eventually, it would become pretty standard at HP for a single person to hold the titles of CEO, president, and chairman.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, that's divided up. Packard is CEO and chairman, and Hewlett is the president. And 1964 was also when the 5060A launched.
The atomic clock, new standard for international time.
Yeah, atomic clocks, very, very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing says what time is it like atomic decay.
Yep. And again, if you look at one of these things, it doesn't look like your average desk or your clock radio that sits on your bedside table. It's a big machine with lots of things on it.
Right. It's not when Mickey's big hand is on the mushroom cloud and his little hand is on the Manhattan Project. That means it's time to get out of the house. Crawl into something that's lead.
Yeah. There's a completely different clock from the bulletin, the atomic scientists that measures that.
I read a different brochure than you did.
Anyway.
Okay.
So should we get into the 1966 period?
Sure.
That's when HP Laboratories.
Laboratories.
Oh, no.
Laboratories.
That was the first time at which they actually said, hey, let's set aside a group of people dedicated to come up with new and cool stuff.
Yeah, this is their research and development arm, where they're really looking into breaking ground in new technologies, which, you know, again, HP wasn't so concerned with previously in its history. It's not that they weren't innovative. They really looked at improving existing technologies, making them more affordable, making them more efficient. And both Hewlett and Packard were known for designing their own, you know, devices that would later become products within the HP line. But this is a group specifically dedicated to, hey guys, make new stuff.
Yep. And they picked a guy named Barney Oliver to lead the group.
Yep. He was the founding director of HP Labs.
Mm-hmm.
And 1966 was also when a new first for HP launched.
The 2116A?
Yes. First computer by HP.
Have you seen this thing?
Yes, when Mickey's big hand is on the mushroom cloud. No, I did see this. It was, It was pretty big. Although we should say not as big as some of the other computers that were just hitting the market in the mid 60s.
I love the language that HP used on its timeline for this. The first go anywhere, do anything computer.
Yes.
Yes, if you had a forklift.
Right, but still, it was not the size
not
of
a
an
laptop.
Entire room. It wasn't as big as an entire room like some computers were.
Yes, this is not what you would consider a netbook, however.
No, but it was the first time that HP used integrated circuits in its electronics. And the computer was meant to work in a quote-unquote average environment, meaning that you wouldn't necessarily have to have a heavily air-conditioned room with
right.
spring-loaded floors so that it could support this machine and make sure that it doesn't overheat. You know, the idea was that HP was trying to aim for a market for businesses that needed computing power but didn't necessarily have the money to spend not just on the computer, but also on completely renovating a part of their building so that it could support a computer.
Right, right.
Because think about that. Let's say that you own a business already, and it's a successful business, and you need a computer for some reason, like database management. And you realize that if you were to buy the computer, not only would it cost an astronomical amount, but you would have to completely change at least part of your building so that it could hold a computer. This was kind of HP's solution to that problem. And it originally had 4K of magnetic core memory, expandable
yep.
up to 32K.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's important, too, to note that they developed this device very quickly for a device like it. And it was fairly rare for a computer to ship with its own software at this point. But,
yeah.
but this one did. As a matter of fact, it took several data systems engineers and DIMEC employees working together to get this thing going. But it did power the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute's work for many years.
Yeah, and it was actually used on a boat.
Yes, it was.
So it was exposed to sea air and was still able to work for more than a decade.
You mean the chain?
Yeah.
That was the research vessel that used this computer.
And so the original cost for one of these things, depending on if you wanted it totally tricked out or not, the base
totally
cost
tricked
was,
out. You mean yeah. with the flame paint job and the side
and the
exhaust stacks?
And the glowing undercarriage?
Yeah.
Tricked out meaning that it had 32K of memory.
You hear it going down the street going boom.
The base price was The base price was $25,000, and the upper level of it was $50,000, which in today's dollars, because you knew I had to do that, right?
Yep.
$146,971 for the cheap version.
Cheap.
Or $293,943 for the expensive one. So more than $250,000 if you wanted to have that 32K of memory.
Yep.
Boy, I'm glad the memory prices have gone down recently.
Well, it's interesting. We should probably step it up because we're hoping to make it to the 80s here. But that is an important product. Also, the next one that I had was the one they came out with in 1968, which, depending on how you looked at it, was the first personal computer.
Yeah, if you looked at the advertising, it was the
advertising
first personal computer. So this is the first documented case of the term personal computer. And it's for the HP 9100A.
Yes.
And this was not a personal computer the way you and I are familiar. It's not like a desktop computer you sit down or even a laptop or anything. No, it was a scientific calculator. It was meant as a personal computer in the sense that it could compute operations. Like
yeah.
you would put in a scientific operation and it could give you the answer.
Yeah.
It wasn't meant as a computer that would run programs the way that modern computers do.
Well, Wired magazine said it was the first personal computer. And I would argue that if you take it in the literal sense, they're probably right. It's a fairly big machine. Again, there are photos of it on the HP website. But it was a pretty significant machine. I mean, compared to other devices that would do this level of work, you know, it was a smaller device mm-hmm. and it could be used, you know, pretty easily. It is bulky by today's terms by every stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
But it could do a lot. And it was, you know, able, you could put this on your desk.
Yes.
So, you know, I think it's when you take it down to the term computer, I think that's an accurate description. But yeah, it doesn't do all the stuff that you're not going to play Farmville on this.
Yeah, you're not going to think of it as a PC.
No.
But that is interesting that it was the first documented case of personal computer. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that that term wasn't used before this. It's just this is the earliest documented instance.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1969, the United States calls upon Packard.
Yeah, again.
So Hewlett had Hewlett had served time in the United States Army as an officer.
Yeah.
From 41 through 47.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1969, the United States government called upon Packard and appointed him to be the U.S. Deputy of Defense.
Yeah.
So Hewlett became the CEO, the president and CEO in Packard's absence.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty significant because, again, one of the commitments that he wanted to make for the company was service.
Right. Serving your community and serving your country. And yeah, 1969 through 1972, that's an extensive time period for any, you know, industry leader to step away and refocus on, a government position.
Mm-hmm. And this is also a time when the company is sort of gradually expanding its work to include more than just measurement and medical devices, but they're also getting in on the ground floor of what would become personal computing.
Right. So 1971, HP introduces laser interferometers, which take measurements using lasers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that they started to get into that. 1972, they introduced the HP 3000, which was a computer meant for businesses. It wasn't a personal computer, but it was meant to help businesses manage databases.
Mm-hmm.
And they also introduced the HP 35.
Now the HP 35, actually there were a couple models. Well, sort of. The HP 35 Classic is a handheld calculator.
Yeah.
They did, however, offer Mr. Hewlett an abacus version of it.
Nice.
They took a shell and put an abacus where the buttons would be and presented it to him. There's a photo of it. It's classic. It's an awesome joke. Apparently, he thought it was hilarious.
I didn't see this one, but that does sound like something he would appreciate.
Generally, I try not to hold stuff up where Jonathan can see it during the podcast because he, you know, sort of goes, huh?
Especially since I don't have my glasses on.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll show it to you later. But yeah, when I think of calculators in the 1970s, I think of TI. Texas Instruments, a company we have already talked about.
Sure.
But HP was definitely right in there with them, mixing it up.
Mm-hmm.
And the HP 35 was one of the workhorses of the 70s handheld calculators.
Yeah, and HP claims it's the first handheld scientific calculator. So not necessarily the first handheld calculator, but first handheld scientific calculator.
Right. So they were doing science.
Yes. This is a triumph. Making a note here. Huge success.
Look at us here talking when there's science to be done.
1973.
The HP 45?
Is that the one that can print in Japanese? Because there is, in 1973, they did introduce a scientific calculator that could print in Japanese. That was actually, that sounds like it might be pretty trivial, but really when you think about how complex it is to be able to print in a another language like that, especially one that has a completely different concept as far as alphabets are concerned, it's a big deal.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
The 45 had numbered data registers, the ability to store and recall math, and could do built-in conversion.
It's better at math than I am, then. I can't store and recall.
Also had a hidden timer inside. So if you weren't doing your work fast enough, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
And the HP 80 was the first pocket-sized business calculator, which was following on the HP 35 success.
Yep. And it
had an HP, there was an HP 81, which had a desktop printing capability too.
So in 1974, HP produced the first mini computer to rely on dynamic random access memory chips, or DRAM.
We've talked about that recently on the show.
And they also created the first programmable pocket calculator.
I'm the operator of my pocket calculator.
1975, they introduced an interface bus, which was, this is what lets computers work with other devices.
Yes. So it's a place where you plug in other stuff.
Right. So, I mean, again, it sounds like, well, know, what's the big deal there? Well, if you don't have one of these, then your devices are all working independently of each other, and in order for you to you know, plug in information from one to another, you have to do it manually. This would allow devices to actually communicate with one another. Pretty limited basis at this point in the history of computing, but still a big development.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep, and you can tell, again, we're getting into the era where things are supposed to talk to other things. So if you had a calculator, you might need it to print. And you might want a pocket calculator that might need to be attached to a printer, or a computer that might need to be attached to a printer. So that, something like that is very important.
And then, so my next note is in 1977.
Oh, in 1977. Well, I had the HP 97, which is yet another calculator. Again, they're making business machines, but if you think about it, a measuring device might be used by the engineers in the department of a different company.
Yeah.
So this is my take on this. You start thinking about scientific calculators, handheld calculators, pocket calculators. These are the kinds of things that might be used by the engineers and the business people.
Yeah,
at
the
a
accounting
company.
Side or yeah, this is we're starting
marketing.
To see, yeah, we're starting to see a transition
departments.
Where the devices are getting less specialized.
Yes.
And really you can look at this also as a slow move toward the consumer market.
Mm-hmm.
It would still be a while before we actually hit true consumer products through HP, but it's a good indicator. So in 77, Hewlett retires as president, but he remains the CEO.
Yeah.
And a fellow by the name of John Young becomes the president of HP.
Yes.
And Packard remains the chairman of the board.
Yes. Did you want to talk about the HP 01?
Well, I don't have any notes on it, so I could, but if I do, I'm going to be making it all up.
The HP 01 calculator watch. It looked like a digital watch, but had a calculator in there. It had more than 36 functions, according to HP.
So we're beginning to learn a lot more about Mr. Paulette in this podcast as his excitement over calculators becomes something troubling to me.
Well, sometimes you need that extra digit. I love the way this says. The copy on the HP website said it allowed you to manipulate and interrelate time. So apparently you could go forward and backward in time.
So then you could go back to 1957, buy and, that stock, and head forward
exactly.
to 1999 and sell it.
It was codenamed Cricket, and it was a business failure. It was huge, and they only sold it through...
Like huge as in it was a large... Watch?
You couldn't lift your arm.
Wow.
Put your arms down when you get to school. No, I'm kidding. I'm teasing. But it was bulky. If you look, again, they have photos on the HP site. It was not a small device by today's terms. But it did have a stylus built into the bracelet part of the watch.
Wow.
So you could use it for that. It was also to the point where they only sold it in high-end jewelry stores. So, you know... However, because the miniaturization was kind of proprietary, you might say, as soon as they discontinued its manufacture, they destroyed it so that they couldn't that no one else could get hold of the it wouldn't fall into the wrong hands.
Well, if you got a time machine, you got to be able to destroy it, because otherwise, who knows who could get hold of it?
Yes, yes. But at the time it was released, you could buy one for $650 for the silver version or $750 for the gold version.
Wow,
not cheap.
No.
That's not cheap in today's dollars.
No.
So anyhow, we're getting close to the end of the 70s.
Yeah, 1978. Hewlett retires completely from the company. And John Young becomes president and CEO. Well, Hewlett,
they had trouble truly retiring.
Yeah, well, it was their baby.
I don't blame them.
They made this company, but he's no longer the head of the company. John Young is both president and CEO at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1979, HP creates the HP Company Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, the revenues for the company are at $2.4 billion with a B dollars, and HP employs more than 50,000 people.
Yes, and this is when they decide that HP would be far more successful if disco music weren't popular. So they began a campaign to end the popularity
Killed
of disco. I'm kidding.
That's 40 years after the founding of the company.
That's true.
And now they
huge success.
Yeah.
I mean, no portal joke intended there.
Exactly. I
mean, really absolutely established itself as a massive success.
And this marks a time where, you know, in 1980, we're going to see some interesting developments, including HP's move into the industries that we're familiar with today, the consumer industries we're familiar with today.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that will serve as our third and final part of the HP story. Mm-hmm. As it stands today. Clearly, the company is still going as we speak, so it's not that their history is over, but we are going to cover from 1980 up to present day, as of the recording of this podcast anyway, in our next segment.
Yes, it gets considerably messier in the next segment.
Yeah, this is where we start to wince, and we'll get into why that is. And it's a complex story and not an entirely happy one.
No.
But still very important company. So we will cover that in our next episode. If you guys have any suggestions for topics you would like us to cover, whether it's another focus on a company or an innovator, or if it's a specific product or just a concept in technology in general, let us know. You can drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is TechStuffHSW. And Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?